From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Walter Kern talks about his new novel, Up in the Air, a satire about air travel and the airlines which control where you go, when you go, what you eat, and if you eat. The main character is a business traveler who virtually lives in the air and is obsessed with logging 1 million frequent flyer miles. Also, former casting director Joanna Merlin tells us about her 25 years of auditioning actors for Broadway and film. She was Hal Prince's casting director. She's written a new book about auditions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. Florida Governor Jeb Bush is hailing the White House decision to scale back planned offshore oil and gas drilling near the Florida Gulf Coast. Buzz Conover of Florida Public Radio has the details.
The original lease would have allowed oil rigs within 20 miles of the Florida Panhandle's Gulf Coast, but the compromise plan now keeps oil drilling at least 100 miles from the Sunshine State. Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who has long opposed offshore oil drilling, calls the move a win for Florida, and his sentiments are being echoed by environmental groups, but that's not the tune being echoed by Florida Democrats. State House Minority Leader Lois Frankel, who's contemplating a bid for governor, is calling the decision the beginning of the Bush oil machine's encroachment on Florida. For NPR News, I'm Buzz Conover in Tallahassee, Florida.
Vice President Dick Cheney looks great. That's what his boss had to say after Cheney's weekend surgery to implant a special device that regulates heartbeat and restarts the heart. President Bush says he is not worried about Cheney because he's doing great. Mr. Bush says Cheney was on time for his early meetings this morning and was very active during the sessions. Cheney now has a device implanted in his chest that will keep his heartbeat steady. His spokesman says he had a typical day holding various meetings, but with no public events on his schedule. A new report finds that the manufacturing sector of the economy lost more ground last month, but a separate report showed consumer spending on the rise. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The National Association of Purchasing Managers said its index of manufacturing activity rose more than 2.5 points to 44.7 in June. That suggests manufacturing continues to decline, but at a slower pace than in May. Any index reading below 50 indicates that the sector is in a downturn. It was the 11th straight month of contraction in manufacturing. But American consumers appear unfazed by the slowdown and job losses in the manufacturing sector. According to the Commerce Department, they continued to shop freely in May, boosting consumer spending by 0.5%. Much of the spending growth was on big-ticket items like automobiles. In fact, spending growth outpaced income growth, sending the U.S. private savings rate to a negative 1.3%, matching a record low. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
Comair returned to the sky today after a crippling three-month strike. Before the strike, Comair was the nation's second-largest regional airline, but it now faces new competition and a slowing economy that has hurt airlines in general. Pilots struck the Delta Airlines' own carrier over wages and benefits. The new contract gives them a company-paid retirement plan and the best pay in the regional airlines industry. Comair took off today from Cincinnati to 26 cities. The Dow closed up 91 points at 10,593. The Nasdaq closed down 12 points at 2148. And the S&P was up 12 points. This is NPR News. Contract negotiations for Hollywood TV and movie actors resume this morning. As John Raby of member station KPCC reports, the two sides seem close to a deal.
The contract deadline was midnight Saturday, but the producers and the actors' unions, SAG and AFTRA, blew past it. They spent 14 hours talking Sunday, the longest session in the 6 weeks of bargaining. Although there's a news blackout, the two sides are said to be near resolution. The key points remaining are reportedly minimum salaries, employer contributions to health and pension plans, and residuals for primetime TV shows rerun on cable. Pretty much no one expects a strike anymore. The recent successful resolution of the writers' contract talks bodes well for these talks. The talks are also said to be friendly. Negotiators have celebrated at least one birthday, have been seen tossing a football around, and the president of SAG broke away to celebrate his 50th wedding anniversary this weekend. For NPR News, I'm John Raby in Los Angeles.
An airline industry analyst says don't shed tears for the decision that could mean merger talks between United Airlines and U.S. Airways are off. Michael Boyd said it's a win-win situation that will let United focus on its own challenges and U.S. Airways work on becoming a standalone airline. For flyers, it means there will still be competition. Reports say United wants out of the $4.3 billion purchase because of regulatory problems and the worsening economy. A brief statement from the two carriers says they're talking about possibly abandoning their merger sometime before the 1st of August. The wings are off and technicians are making final preparations to ship the dismantled U.S. surveillance plane from China to the U.S. The plane and its crew were seized by China in April after it collided with a Chinese fighter jet. China allowed the crew to return home 11 days later, but it kept the plane. I'm Mac Lee, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're flying this holiday week, I hope you're on a flight that serves more than pretzels, and that if you're stuck at the airport, it at least has some shops and restaurants to help you kill time. A good book might help. My guest Walter Kern has written a new novel called Up in the Air that's a satire about airports and airplanes and the airlines that control every aspect of your life when you travel. Up in the Air is about a business traveler who virtually lives in what he describes as Air World and has come to feel most at home there. His ambition is to earn 1 million frequent flyer miles, and he's close to achieving it. Walter Kern is the literary editor of GQ and a contributing editor to Time and Vanity Fair. Let's start with a short reading from Up in the Air.
Planes and airports are where I feel at home. Everything fellows like you dislike about them, the dry recycled air alive with viruses, the salty food that seems drizzled with warm mineral oil, the aura-sapping artificial lighting, has grown dear to me over the years, familiar, sweet. I love the Compass Club lounges in the terminals, especially the flagship Denver Club with its digital juice dispenser and deep suede sofas and floor-to-ceiling views of taxiing aircraft. I love the restaurants and snack nooks near the gates, stacked to their heat lamps with whole wheat mini pizzas and gourmet caramel rolls. I even enjoy the sweet hotels built within sight of the runways on the ring roads, which are sometimes as close as I get to the cities that my job requires me to visit. I favor rooms with kitchenettes and conference tables, and once I cooked a Christmas feast in one, serving glazed ham and sweet potato pie to a dozen janitors and maids. They ate with me in rotation on their breaks, one or two at a time, so I really got to know them, even though most spoke no English. I have a gift that way. If you and I hadn't hit it off like this, if the only words we'd passed were, "That's my seat," or "Done with that business week," or just "Excuse me," I'd still regard us as close acquaintances and hope that if we met again up here, we wouldn't be starting from zero as just two suits. Twice last October, I sat in the same row on different routes as 1989's Miss USA, the one who remade herself as a Washington hostess and supposedly works nonstop for voting rights. In person, she's tiny, barely over 5 feet. I put her carry-on in the overhead. But you know some of this already. You fly, too. It just hasn't hooked you. You just don't study it. Hey, you're probably the normal one.
That's Walter Kern reading from his new novel, Up in the Air. Walter Kern, how did you start studying airline culture?
A few years ago, I was on a plane upgraded to first class for some unknown reason, and I sat down next to a businessman. And to make conversation, I asked him where he lived, and he said, well, right here. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And it came out that the man had no home. He traveled on business and lived from hotel to hotel, and airplanes and airports, as in the book, were really his turf. And I asked him after a while how he managed to live like this. Wasn't it depressing and so on? And no, he seemed satisfied and even happy with his life. And after I got off the plane, I thought, now, what kind of life would that be? And over the years, I sort of filled in the blanks, and the result was this book.
Well, you've kind of defined a whole culture as Air World. Describe the culture to us.
Well, Air World is that conglomeration of places that are no place, including airports, the hotels that are just off the runways that serve them, the rental car counter, the whole sort of attempt to satisfy the flyer's needs without any particular offense or any particular flavor. I mean, in Air World, you can come from Dallas, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, or New York and know where you are, know what's on offer, know how to get it, and what you're going to get.
And you write that the hometown papers of Air World are USA Today and the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. Everything is standardized. Everything goes down easily. It's as though the only restaurant in the world were McDonald's and the only hotel in the world was a Holiday Inn. And, you know, people have to be able to rest and feel comfortable and feel at home at any moment, at any time. The result has been this kind of placeless place that I call Air World.
One of the things I found interesting of your whole description of Air World is that in defining this culture of Air World, you've taken one of the more alienating contemporary experiences, flying, an experience in which everyone is a stranger to each other on the plane and everyone is uncomfortable, and you've turned it into this community. I mean, it's not really a community, but, you know, for the purposes of this novel, it's become this, like, anti-community community.
Well, it is a community. I mean, human beings are amazingly adaptable. You bring in a new technology or you force people to live in a new environment, and they find ways to do it. And my character has made friends with the people who, you know, sell the juice at the counter, the person who gives the little chair massages in the terminal. He knows the flight attendants by name. I talked to a traveler once who said, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was flying too much when I walked through the Minneapolis airport and found myself waving to everyone.
Do you fly a lot?
I fly probably twice a month. Journalism brings me out of my Montana home out into Air World pretty regularly. And it's a place, Air World is a place that shows up in high relief when you live on a Montana farm.
Which is where you live.
Exactly.
Right.
It couldn't be more foreign and more alien. And, you know, when you talk about it being an alienating environment, one of the thoughts behind the novel was, if a man's going to have a nervous breakdown, and in a way that's what this book is about, what is the worst place he could possibly have it? And I thought, on a plane, in an airport, you're already halfway there to psychosis.
And what brings you halfway there to psychosis?
First of all, I think the lighting.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's sort of like what they say about Las Vegas. You never know what time it is. In fact, someone once posed a riddle to me, what time is it in the Denver airport? And I said, well, you know, whatever time it says on the clock. But he said, no, there are people there who came from Europe that morning and people who are just in from another time zone. And the lighting shows no sign of weather, sun, or whatever. It's, you know, it's always, it's a little eternity in there, a kind of a hellish little eternity.
Right, right. I managed to read your novel Up in the Air while in the air in my Air Flight magazine on the same day I was reading your book. The back page, I was shocked. It had an ad for enhancing your breast size and another one for male virility enhanced guaranteed. I thought that was were kind of shocking for airline magazines.
Well, that's an odd syndrome. I think when people get on planes, they start to think about improving themselves. They start to think about and get reflective and meditative about where are they going in life? What are they doing in life? And they're prey to these ads for, like you say, you know, breast-enhancing creams and vocabulary-enhancing tape courses. And you'll see those magazines are often aimed at businessmen who are insecure about their negotiating skills, and there will be an ad for a seminar on negotiating or whatever. I think people get a sense of possibility when they're on a plane, even romantic possibility, wondering if the perfect person is going to sit down next to them or something.
Now, although your main character lives in Air World and seems to have kind of bonded with airline culture, he also realizes he hates the airlines. The main airline in your novel is called Great West. And your mm-hmm. character says, for years, Great West has been my boss, my sergeant, dictating where I went and if I went, deciding what I ate and if I ate. Just tell me about writing that sentence and writing that sense of how if you fly a lot, you feel like the airline really is controlling your life, well, even you when know, you can go to the bathroom.
Air travel is infantilizing. You're totally dependent on often unseen people, you know, the pilot behind that curtain up front. What's being served, you don't know until you sit down. And for the sort of high-powered people who do a lot of business travel, it's a curious thing. They're usually so in control and so powerful in their lives and used to ordering people around. And here they're really being told where to sit, you know, what kind of beer they can drink and when they're getting there or if they're getting there. And I think that breeds a strange sort of bitterness and resentment and hostility. You know, you see these flare-ups of air rage in the news nowadays, and it's no surprise. They're like the way infants rail at their parents. You're so powerless in that environment.
One of the things about airports that your character does not like is the art. A lot of airports now have like little art displays as you're leaving the gate. And the strangest one I saw was a collection of Madeleine Albright's brooches.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where was that?
I can't remember which airport it was.
Well, you know, it's a strange challenge these airport designers have. They have to find things that are diverting to the average person, the sort of common denominator American, and they have no idea. So they put out things like Secretary of State's brooches and strange abstract art that's sort of not particularly compelling to anyone, but not offensive to anyone either.
My guest is Walter Kern. His new satirical novel is called Up in the Air. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Kern. His new novel is called Up in the Air, and it's about life in the air and what Kern describes as air world. Now, your main character is a career transition counselor, which he describes as a fancy term for coaching people to understand job loss as an opportunity for personal and spiritual growth. What's his job like, and what do you know about that kind of work? You're a writer, so you're not in that corporate world.
Well, you know, what do writers know about anything? Only what they pick up off the ground, really. This is a real profession. These people, these career transition counselors, come in when a company is downsizing, and they immediately take in hand the discharged executive and attempt to convince her or him that things aren't so bad, they shouldn't sue the company, no, they're not being discriminated against, and here's the way to find a new job. And they sort of coach them through the process, hoping against hope that the person won't become despondent or angry or whatever. And it's a real profession nowadays. And I've seen these people operate, actually, at some of the places I've worked, some of the magazines I've worked.
And why did you want to give this job of career transition counseling to your main character?
Well, I mean, because he's in a kind of limbo personally and in the way he lives. And his job is really to make limbo tolerable to other people. He's found a special sort of talent in himself, which is to feel comfortable not knowing where he's going and in between places. And so it's natural that that talent would come out in counseling people who are in between jobs, in between stations in life. It's a job that he comes to loathe, but it's a job that he's especially suited for.
Your character looks at a lot of advertising, you know, through television and magazines. Mm-hmm. And he says, I know of no pleasure more reliable than consuming a great American brand against the backdrop featured in its advertising, like swigging a Coke on the beach in Malibu. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, since you write for magazines, you've written for New York, for Vanity Fair, GQ is where you are now, you've written for Time magazine. Your work is always surrounded by the kind of advertising you're describing there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I in a way wanted to create a character who's comfortable with all the things that the intelligentsia in America is not comfortable with, i.e. the, you know, vast and oppressive consumer culture. And he's a guy who, for whatever reason, accepts what comes to him and feels comforted by being part of the mass market. And, you know, I think that's an emotion that, that people suppress. In America, we're constantly surrounded by these pitches and appeals and product images. And though they put us off a lot of the time, at certain times we feel sort of privileged and secure because they're almost like mantras or, you know, recurring dreams. And this guy's made his peace with the kind of commercial culture that a lot of us poo-poo.
Because your character is surrounded by this culture of advertising and franchise food and how-to cassettes and self-improvement stuff, did you have to immerse yourself in some of that, too, just so you could get all the language right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we're immersed in it anyway. Really, all I had to do was notice how immersed I already am. Once you're alert to it and not filtering it out, it's sort of the air you breathe. And this was a book that really came about not through doing research or digging, but through waking up to the fact that I lived in this sort of miasma of messages and images, which I often felt superior to and ignored. But suddenly I decided to wake up to it, sort of like Andy Warhol became comfortable with the cannibal soup can. You know, it wasn't as though he'd never been to a supermarket. He just suddenly looked at a supermarket and went, wait, art can happen here, too.
So what were some of the things that started to strike you as interesting instead of filtering them out?
Well, one thing that struck me about Airworld is that it's a class system in a way that most of America isn't. We like to think of ourselves as a democracy and egalitarian, but you get to Airworld and there is a rating and a level for everyone, you know. You see the cards they whip out at the ticket counter. I'm a gold medallion member, or I'm a gold medallion member plus, and that entitles me to X, Y, Z. And there are all these distinctions being made out there between types of people and better customers and, you know, the kind of pillow you're going to get or whether you'll get your glass cup or your plastic cup. And that class system in Airworld I found interesting.
Oh, it's so true, and they even call it class. I mean, it's like first class or coach class. I mean, you know what class you're in and what privileges that class allows you or what miseries you're in store for.
Well, I mean, the higher classes sort of allow the miseries to abate somewhat, though not disappear.
Well, shrimp cocktail will do a lot to abate misery. Yeah,
exactly, and people cling to those little perks when
That's
they're
right.
traveling in a sort of horribly pathetic way, you know. I've noticed that the few times I've traveled first class myself, you've already got your drink and your coat has been taken by the time the rest of the passengers file on. And it's hard not to feel sorry for them. They're sort of trooping past you like cows to slaughter. And you're sitting there in your, you know, wide body seat. And the funny thing about that class system is it's not really based on money. You know, some of these guys don't make more money who ride in first class. They just fly a lot, and so the airplane, you know, the airline puts them up. And so it's the one time in their life they get to feel on top of the heap, and they take it for all it's worth.
You know, I used to really envy the people in first class because I figured, God, these people have so much money. They could afford those absolutely absurd ticket prices for first class. And then I realized, no, they're using frequent flyer miles. And I started feeling sorry for them because I realized sitting in first class means you're flying so much that you've racked up enough miles to be able to sit there.
Exactly. And my character is nothing if not obsessed with accumulating frequent flyer miles. In fact, I think it's where he draws his self-esteem. You know, when it goes up from 800,000 to 900,000 miles, he feels that much better about himself and his place in the world. And once you're immersed in that world, they do become a kind of a status symbol. I can't tell you how many conversations I've heard between people sort of comparing miles in a my dog is better than your dog sort of way.
The narrator of your story tells his story as if he was addressing the person sitting next to him on a plane. Do you strike up conversations on planes with the person next to you?
Well, I did for purposes of researching this book, but in general, nothing horrifies me more than to be seated next to a talkative, vibrant person who won't let me read my magazine. And I think that's a kind of nightmare for a lot of people. But my character is sort of a worst-case scenario in that way. He has no other human contact than the people he sits next to on planes, and so he has to bond with absolutely everyone.
Oh, and he's thinking, maybe the woman in 3B is my soulmate.
Well, you know, in the old days, we had this romance of shipboard travel that you got on a ship and sort of went first class, and you were bound to find a romance or love somewhere along the way. Well, he has that attitude toward airplanes. And, you know, in a sense, everybody's single when they're on an airplane, especially if they're not traveling with their family. Everybody's sort of, it's the great singles bar in the air. And this guy looks at it that way.
Walter Kern, his new satirical novel is called Up in the Air. He'll be back in the second half of the show. We'll end this half with music by tenor saxophonist Joe Henderson. He died of heart failure Saturday at the age of 64. We'll hear a track that we often play on Fresh Air, Isfahan, from Joe Henderson's 1992 CD of the music of Billy Strayhorn.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Vintage Books, a division of Random House and publishers of the new paperback novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Walter Kern, author of the satirical novel Up in the Air. Also, former casting director Joanna Merlin. She cast many of Harold Prince's Broadway productions and Bertolucci's film The Last Emperor. She's written a new guide for auditioning actors. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Walter Kern. His new novel, Up in the Air, is a satire about airports and airplanes and the airlines that control every aspect of your life while you fly. Kern is also literary editor of GQ. Now, you've been living on a farm in Montana for about 10 years. Do you think you could have written this novel if you were living in New York and advertising was all around you 24 hours a day?
And no, not really. You know, when I leave my farm in Montana, which is overrun with antelope and wild birds and wild grass, and I get onto an airplane, the contrast could not be more stark. It's like almost traveling through time. And I think a lot of the details that I write about in the book popped out at me because they're so absent in my daily rural life.
Why are you living that daily rural life?
It's easier to write. It's easier to think, and I don't have to spend time in traffic, waiting in lines, shuttling the child from playgroup to playgroup. It's just so much more accommodating in terms of time to live a little bit in the middle of nowhere nowadays.
Do you ever feel like you're a creature from another planet in your community?
Yes, I do. I mean, I live in a community in Montana which has a history of transience. It's a railroad town. All kinds of people came through that town. You'll see their pictures on the wall of the restaurant from way back, you know, Charlie Chaplin on. And so it's a very accepting place and doesn't ask a lot of questions. And that I make my living in New York or writing journalism for places like Time is not ever really remarked on. It's sort of a secret I carry around with me, and we all agree not to talk about it. But I can feel a little different from my farmer neighbors, for example. Yeah.
On the other hand, you did grow up part of the time on a farm in Minnesota.
Your father was a
lawyer, but also had a farm.
Exactly. My father was a man who decided at some point in life that he was going to drop out of the modern world and become as close to Amish as you can without taking the vows. And we farmed with horses and lived out really far from the Twin Cities where he worked. And I guess it was part of that whole 70s back to the land movement. The problem was that only the children had to stay back to the land. He went to a corporate office every day. And, you know, in the book, Ryan also has a rural background. You know, he's come up in a very stable, very rooted place, and he's moved to a very transient and very, very ever-changing atmosphere. And I think there's a mournful quality to the character because he can't quite get back to that sense of rootedness and simplicity that he originally felt in life.
As someone who grew up on a farm, somewhat removed from the throbbing of American pop culture, how do you feel about bringing up your own kids on a farm that's removed from it? Because you write so much about pop culture.
Well, I feel great about raising a child shielded from American pop culture. You know, it's a drug out there, and you never know which drug a child's going to fall for. Will it be the Barney drug or the Britney Spears drug or the nonstop violence drug? And I'd rather impose myself between her and that world. When I was growing up, pop culture seemed to be less intrusive, but it was certainly out there. And I remember the first time I, you know, heard a pop record album, probably 12 years old. Until then, I'd been insulated from that kind of thing. And it hit me like a fork in the face. It was so powerful, so vibrant, so slick. And I've always felt a little vulnerable and hypersensitive even to those images. And I fear for my child, to be honest.
Walter Kern is my guest, and his new novel is called Up in the Air. And it's about what he describes as air world, that kind of airplane and airport culture. You are not only a novelist, you're a book critic, and you've been reviewing books for how many years?
Oh, probably about eight years regularly.
And you're still doing it?
Yeah, now and then, but a little bit less than I used to. My appetite has decreased slightly.
You wrote in a recent piece that when you started reviewing books, a friend who was a writer gave you this advice. He said, every time you write a bad review, you'll be hurting people in your own field. Also, what goes around comes around. Watch out. Mm-hmm. The next time you mm-hmm. publish your own work, they'll be laying for you.
Yeah.
So what is it like as a book critic to have a novel coming out, and this isn't your first, and to get a taste of your own medicine, so to speak?
Well, I'd like to say, as I've heard other people who are critics say, oh, from being a critic, I know that reviewing is a bunch of baloney, so I don't even bother to read the reviews, or if they're negative, they don't touch me. Well, that's just not true with me. I'm a human being, and to me, writing and writing criticism are like playing a sport and also being a referee in that sport. And when you're a referee and you've got the referee's uniform on and you make the calls, you think, now, don't these people realize it's absolutely necessary that we have guidelines and someone calling fouls and so on? And then when you're playing the sport and the referee makes a call you don't like, you're outraged. And that's how it works for me. I mean, when I get a bad review of my book or one that I think doesn't understand it or slights it in some way, I'm hurt. It doesn't feel good. And writing criticism of my own has not numbed that sensitivity.
As a book critic, when you read a book, you're reading it and thinking about what works and what doesn't in the plot and the writing. You're mm-hmm. reading it very analytically. Does that ever get in the way as a writer, that analytical approach to reading?
Absolutely. It's terribly inhibiting to be a critic who writes. I end up reviewing my own book as I write it, and that's a very bad habit to get into. You know, I'll get to the end of a page of fiction and think, well, you know, a little weak, strays from the theme, dialogue is fuzzy, nobody talks that way, and I've broken my own momentum. I really have to set aside that critical part of my brain in order to write at all. Have to pretend that I'm sitting alone on a beach struck by inspiration.
I think for a lot of writers, there's this kind of bargain that you make. I'm going to sit down and force myself to write for 2 more hours, and then I'm getting out of the house, and I'm going to a movie, or I'm mm-hmm. going to the bar, or I'm going to a friend's house, or I'm taking a train and going someplace. I mean, whatever it is that you need to convince yourself you're going to do in that 2 hours when you're free. Living on a farm in a comparatively remote area, what do you do for that part of the bargain?
Well, to get away from my work, I irrigate alfalfa. I go out and I make little dams on little ditches full of water and run the water across the hay and watch it grow, which couldn't be further than sitting at a desk. Unfortunately, because I live on a farm, I'm able to go huge stretches without thinking about anything else but work. And when I was writing this book, I found myself at times becoming so swept up in the darn thing that I didn't have a conversation about anything else but airports for 6 days. There was no one to stop me.
Well, who would you talk to about airports?
Oh, myself. Really, just myself. I'm one of those writers who keeps everything absolutely private until the book is finished. I don't
right.
want to hear anybody's suggestion or anybody's reaction. It'll break the spell. So I go into a very strange, narcissistic dream world and try not to let it shatter for as long as possible.
Since you brought up airports again, let me share one of the things that really bothers me about flying. Tell me if you experience this. You know how about 15 minutes after the meal is served and eaten, suddenly, like, intestinal gas starts wafting across the plane, and you're stuck in this plane of strangers inhaling it, and there's no place to go, and you don't want to be thinking about, well, who's responsible for this? You know, and so you just, no one says anything. No one ever says anything, and everybody's just kind of quietly
yeah.
inhaling.
Yeah. In terms of passing gas, airplanes are a no-fault environment. Everybody has to be willing to assume guilt and yet not attribute it to others. I mean, one of the things that's so horrible about traveling is that, you know, we're thrust up against each other's biological selves. you know, we may all be dressed for business, but we're, you know, our stomachs are rumbling and we have to go to the bathroom. Heck, I feel embarrassed every time I have to stand up and ask my seatmate to move his knees so I can go to the bathroom, especially if I do it twice on one flight. I can't tell you how many times I've sat there thinking, I already made him move once. Yes, I have to urinate terribly, but I don't want him to think I'm ill or have a problem. And so I just, you know, sit there clenching every muscle until we're let out into the terminal.
Well, Walter Curran, what a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Walter Curran's new satirical novel about air travel is called Up in the Air. Coming up, Joanna Merlin discusses her 25 years as casting director for Broadway and film. This is Fresh Air. Most actors dread auditions where they have only a few minutes to prove themselves to the casting director. My guest Joanna Merlin has been on both sides of the process. For 25 years, she was a casting director for Broadway and film. As Harold Prince's casting director, she worked on the original Broadway productions of Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, and Evita. She also cast Bernardo Bertolucci's epic movie, The Last Emperor. As an actress, she's appeared in the original Broadway production of Fiddler on the Roof and the films Class Action, Mystic Pizza, The Killing Fields, and The Ten Commandments. She co-founded the Nontraditional Casting Project and now teaches in the graduate acting program of New York University. She's written a new book called Auditioning, An Actor-Friendly Guide. I asked Joanna Merlin how she became a casting agent.
Well, oddly enough, I had never thought about being a casting person. I had two babies and thought, well, I don't want to go on the road. I'm not sure if I can act full time anymore. What will I do? And out of the blue, Hal Prince called me. I had met him when he was producing Fiddler on the Roof, which I had done a few years before. And he got this sort of crazy notion that because I was an actor and I was a Jewish mother and I would like actors and had been around New York for a while, that I might be a good casting director. And I thought it was an insane idea. But he had two babies the same age as mine. And he said, I don't care when you're there. I don't care what your hours are, as long as you get the work done. And I sort of went into it blindly and very naively because there were five shows going and there was a lot of work. But somehow or another, because he was so free about my when I was there, I managed it. And I really got an education sort of learning on the job.
Now, you did the auditioning for Sweeney Todd, the Stephen Sondheim show?
Yes.
Did Angela Lansbury, who was one of the stars, have to audition?
No, she didn't. She did not, nor did Len Cariou. Len Cariou had worked for Steve and Hal before, and they knew his work. I mean, if they know an actor's work and they feel that this actor can play this character and they don't have doubts about it, and if they know that the vocal range is okay. Now, for Angela, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if Steve might have written some of the songs within Angela's range. And that happens when you start with a star. And frequently, producers and directors will get a star before the whole show is written, and they will write around them.
And what did you ask the other performers in Sweeney Todd to do for auditions?
Well, Sweeney Todd required great voices. And so everyone had to sing very, very well. Also, we were looking for interesting character types. The Beatle had to be we wanted him to be a very large man. And the part of Tobias was to be someone a little bit eccentric looking and strange. And a lot of the people in the chorus needed to be kind of interesting types. So each show really presents a different challenge, and it's one of the things that makes it so interesting.
What are some of the traps in auditioning you'd caution people to not fall into?
Actors tend to overcomplicate the material when it's certainly not required. Also, they frequently don't listen to the reader. Very common mistake. They're focusing only on their own lines. Sometimes they tend to speed through the audition. Fast audition is a good audition, but it isn't necessarily. And I think the most common mistake is trying to be a blank slate, trying to second-guess the director, going in, giving a sort of straight, intelligent reading without making a strong choice. And actors must come in and make strong choices because directors want to feel that they can collaborate with them. They don't want to feel that the actor is totally dependent on the director.
I've interviewed several actors over the years who believe that they got certain parts through sheer chutzpah, through doing something very outrageous at the audition or dressing outrageously or even showing up at the director's home and refusing to go away until the director promised to hear them audition. How wise is that? I mean, do you know people who actually got their parts through that kind of brazen act?
Well, I think that as a rule, it's a little risky because casting directors don't like you to go over their heads. However, it reminded me of one thing that happened when I was casting Sweeney Todd. This young woman whom I didn't know wanted an audition. And it's always difficult to know how many people to bring in that you don't know because there's a limited amount of time. In any event, one day at the office, there arrived a box with a pie in it, with a plastic arm and hand sticking out of the pie. And, of course, the show is about the demon barber of Fleet Street who kills people in his barber chair and then grinds them up and so on. And I thought, well, you know, this is pretty inventive. And I did give her an audition. She didn't get the part. But you really have to make a decision on the basis of talent. And no matter what an actor does, to sort of twist your arm, that ultimately the decision is going to be because that is a good actor for the role.
Actors' agents are always trying to get casting directors to see their actors. What are some of the things agents have done to inspire you to see their people? Little gifts maybe they give or whatever. And what are the ethics of that?
Well, I think ordinarily one doesn't accept gifts. I remember, though, when I was casting A Little Night Music, Eric Shepard at ICM had asked me if we would see Hermione Gingold for the role of Madame Armfeldt. And she was very, very different than Hal Prince's concept of this role. And she had read the script and wanted to audition, and her agent called several times, but Hal's concept was totally different. And I set up the appointment anyway and took a chance. And, of course, she came in and blew everybody away. But it was because of her persistence, really, that we saw her. And the same thing happened, actually, with Mandy Patinkin. You know, for Evita, his agent wanted him to audition for the part of Che Guevara, but nobody had ever heard him sing. And it was just on the final day, Hal called me in the morning and said, I looked at the list. I don't think we have enough really good people for Che Guevara. Call somebody else in. So I sort of tracked him down that morning. He came in, read the material cold, sang this incredible song, High Flying Adored, without ever having seen it before. And Tim Rice, who was the composer and they had had Evita playing for a year in England, said, "This was the best I have ever heard that song sung." And, of course, he got the part.
My guest is Joanna Merlin. Her new book is a guide for actors called Auditioning. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Joanna Merlin, author of the new book Auditioning. She's Hal Prince's former casting director, and she cast the Bernardo Bertolucci movie The Last Emperor. I asked her about casting The Last Emperor in China.
The problem was that we needed actors who spoke English, and there aren't a lot of actors in China who speak English, at least at that time, which was 1984. Things have changed a lot since then. And I did some in New York, some in L.A., San Francisco, Hong Kong, Taiwan. But the auditioning in China was really interesting because they have companies there. They have film companies, theater companies, so the actors don't audition. And every morning at 9 o'clock, I would open the door to my hotel room, and there would be about 20 Chinese actors, none of whom really spoke English, and they would all come in my room for the day, and they would all smoke. So by the end of the day, you could barely make your way through the haze. And I would go around to each one of them to see if they could say a few words in English and then sometimes tape something for them, and then they would try to learn it and come back. But they all had a wonderful time because it was sort of a new experience.
Did you cast the leads in The Last Emperor, too?
I did. As a matter of fact, when I met Bertolucci, I had already done a lot of Asian casting. And in those years, there were not many Asians who were in the profession. The first time I cast them was in Sondheim's Pacific Overtures. And that took me a year to find a full cast. So Bernardo said he was looking for the Emperor, Puyi, and the Empress. And he wanted them to look like the pictures of the real people. And I said to him, there's only one person that I know in the world who can play the Emperor, and that's John Lone. And the only other woman I know who could play the Empress is Joan Chen. And I said, I'll be happy to, you know, do a search, but that's my feeling. And they did end up playing the parts because, and they were wonderful. They were wonderful. I think he chose them because they were wonderful. So that I didn't have to do a huge search.
You said that when Hal Prince made you his casting director, totally surprising you, that part of what he was looking for was somebody who was a Jewish mother, which you were. Why should that be a qualification for a casting director?
Well, I think that actors respond to casting directors who are supportive and encouraging. And that if they feel that the moment they walk in the room they're being challenged, then it's a turnoff. And there are some people who are in casting who are not supportive and who can be somewhat abusive, although I think most casting directors try to conduct themselves with understanding and some graciousness. But it's very helpful to an actor if they feel that you're on their side. And indeed, casting directors are rooting for you. I mean, they want to cast the role, and so they're rooting for every actor that walks in the door, as are directors.
You have an interesting audition story yourself about the time you auditioned to play one of the daughters in the original Broadway production of Fiddler on the Roof. Tell us about the audition and the role you were initially going after.
Well, I had met Jerry Robbins, who was the director, when I was auditioning for him for Mother Courage, which he did on Broadway. And he'd brought me in four times and then didn't cast me. So when he was doing Fiddler, he remembered me and called me in for the part of Huddle. And I'm not really a singer, but he sort of had it in his mind that I could play this role. And it was in a soprano voice. And I came in time and time again. He kept bringing me in. I couldn't understand why, but he had this idée fixe that he needed me in the show. And finally, he had me work with Sheldon and Jerry, who had written the score, the lyricist and the composer, and to learn the song and work on it. And I came back and I sang it. It was still terrible. And so he said, this was the seventh audition, he said, would you mind if I came to your voice lesson with you and heard all the songs you sing? And I nearly fell off the stage, but he did. And I'll never forget, it was a rainy day, and we went to this Carmen Gagliardi's voice studio on West 71st Street, and there was Jerry Robbins tromping up on the elevator with me, and he had me sing all these songs and picked out a song that was in a different range. It was in my chest voice, which was still not great, but it was better. And so he said, that's what you have to sing for the next audition. So there it was, the eighth audition. I sang the song, and Jerry and Sheldon stood up in the audience and said, she's got a chest voice. She can play Seidel. So I got the part.
Seidel's the other daughter.
Seidel is the older daughter who marries Muddle the Tailor, and she doesn't sing very much. And they kind of wrote a section of Matchmaker that had a range of about four tones that I could manage.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Joanna Merlin's new book is a guide for actors called Auditioning. She teaches at the NYU Graduate Acting Program. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Hall, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Hoddle, oh Hoddle, have I made a match for you? He's handsome, he's young, all right, he's 62, but he's a nice man, a good catch, true, true. I promise you'll be happy, and even if you're not, there's more to life than that. Don't ask me what. Chava, I found him, will you be a lucky bride? He's handsome, he's tall, that is from side to side, but he's a nice man, a good catch, right? Right. You heard he has a temper, he'll beat you every night, but only when he's sober, so you're all right. Did you think you'd get a prince? Well, I do the best I can. With no dowry, no money, no family background, be glad you got a man. Matchmaker, matchmaker, you know that I'm still very young. Please take your time. Up to this minute, I misunderstood that I could get stuck for good. Dear Yenta, see that he's gentle. Remember, you were also a bride. It's not that I'm sentimental. It's just that I'm terrified.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, a work of fiction by David Schickler. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the new parody of Gone with the Wind. We meet Alice Randall, author of The Wind Done Gone. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.